This is your host, Morgan Reynolds, on the Dynamic Duo, where you can catch Jim Fetzer Tuesdays through Thursdays and Kevin Barrett, the Boy Wonder, on Mondays and Fridays. I'm substituting this week for Jim, who's off on a cruise to some exotic locale or other. And it's a pleasure and a privilege, really, to fill in for Jim these 3 days. And today I have, as a guest, Mark Thornton, who is an economist. So while this might sound dismal to have two economists chit-chatting about the state of the world and the history of the Federal Reserve and the future of the economy, I don't think it's very dismal. We're living in exciting times. Students I always complain that economics is dry and difficult, but it has that virtue of being directly connected to your wallet and your standard of living. So nobody denies its importance. Good afternoon, Mark. How you doing?
Good afternoon, Morgan. I'm doing great, and it's a pleasure to be with you here today.
Yeah, I think we're going to have some fun. Let me give some background on Mark, who's highly qualified to engage in this conversation. He's a senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. That's always a tongue twister for me. He is a book review editor of the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics, and he's on the editorial board of the Journal of Libertarian Studies. Both, I call those pluses. And he has been on the faculty at Auburn University and Columbus State University. He's taught at Auburn U at Montgomery and Trinity in Texas. He's been an assistant superintendent of banking and economic advisor to Governor Bob James of Alabama in the late 90s, and he's gotten a few awards, including a University Research Award at Columbus State. And his books have some interesting titles: Economics of Prohibition, Tariffs, Blockades, and Inflation, and the Quotable Mises. And he's got his PhD in economics from Auburn, and he's a grad of St. Bonaventure University. I remember, I'm a whole lot more mature than Mark, and I remember years ago St. Bonaventure used to have a heck of a men's college basketball program. Bob Lanier, the famous Bob Lanier, wow, what a smooth, incredible college center. Mark, where the heck is St. Bonaventure anyway?
St. Bonaventure is out in the middle of nowhere in western New York State, south of Buffalo. And it's on the Allegheny River, and it's just north of the Pennsylvania border. And they still had Bob Lanier's size 15 sneakers in the library under a glass case when I was there. He was, of course, the most famous basketball player and almost took us to a national title. Before being injured, and but you know the team has gone downhill in the era of televised basketball. They've kind of slipped a little bit, and
they're not on the college basketball map. You know, Gonzaga is another smaller school that is, you know, a top 10, top 20 type club. Well, it was a pleasure watching Bob Lanier. Interesting that you're a grad from there.
Yes.
Now, well, I think the best way to start in here is to... I was looking at prudentbear.com, one of my econ finance websites that I like, and they just turned it over, but they had some great headlines, including Bernanke signals bold rate action to lift growth. Ben Bernanke, of course, the recently appointed head of the Federal Reserve System, which is going to be, I think, a target for us this afternoon. And Bernanke, addressing a group today in Washington, D.C., said that, and I quote, "In light of recent changes in the outlook for and the risks to growth, additional policy easing may be necessary." Then there was a related headline where it said gold went up to nearly $900 an ounce in reaction, and bonds slipped bond prices rose and therefore interest rates fell, anticipating this cut in the target interest rate for the Fed of a half a percentage point here at the end of the month when they're scheduled to meet. So my first question to you, Mark, is what does he mean when he says additional policy easing may be necessary?
Well, you know, I don't know. As an investor in gold and silver, I'm not sure whether I should hate Ben Bernanke or love Ben Bernanke. But,
but yeah, I'm, you know, I'm with you.
He is they call him Helicopter Ben because of his threat to use helicopters to go out and just drop money all over the country and just flood the market with new money and new credit. And, you know, true to his reputation, he's cutting interest rates and flooding the market with new credit. And he's even forcing money into the market by auctioning off reserves to financial institutions so they can't just sit on the side. Somebody's got to go into that auction market and take in those reserves. So he's acting as boldly as any Fed president chairman has ever done in light of the situation with the U.S. dollar, which is falling apart, hitting
right.
all-time lows. Gold is hitting all-time highs. Silver right now just hit a 28-year high. So
has it crossed $16 an ounce yet? It was about $15.50 in FRNs, Federal Reserve Notes.
Yeah, it crossed 16. I'm not sure what it's at right now, but the news reports are indicating that it's at a 28-year high. So I'm assuming that's still over 16.
You know, to be a little less than entirely serious, I would prefer this kind of a helicopter drop as opposed to the insiders getting first dibs on these newly created reserves, especially this new auction method he's got where they can get plenty of bucks for, 4.3% per year. I have a truck note. It's 6.99%.
Well, as you know, Morgan, the purpose is not to just drop money into the economy so that you might get your hands on some of it. The purpose of this is to give it to their buddies in the banking industry, Wall Street, and the financial industry. It's a bailout of these institutions. It's not a bailout of mortgage holders. It's not a bailout of car note holders. It's not for the regular guy. It's for Bear Stearns and Bank of America and Morgan and all the rest there.
Who just need some big transfusions, some of which is coming from these overseas statist investment banks, so-called sovereign funds, and they're injecting big bucks into Citi and Merrill Lynch and Bear Stearns, et cetera.
Yes, these sovereign funds are providing billions of dollars for our financial institutions to get them out of hot water. And, you know, I'm not completely opposed to that. You know, that's one way of unwinding all of this bad loans without these financial houses coming unglued. So that's not all to the bad, except that we realize that foreigners are getting a bigger chunk of the U.S. economy.
Yeah, some losers.
Yeah.
Well, we'll be back after this break and with more from Mark Thornton, economist at the Mises Institute. This is your host, Morgan Reynolds, on the Dynamic Duo, where you can catch Jim Fetzer Tuesdays through Thursdays and Kevin Barrett, the Boy Wonder, on Mondays and Fridays. I'm substituting this week for Jim, who's off on a cruise, he told me. And today we have as my special guest, Mark Thornton from the Mises Institute down in Auburn, Alabama, the great home of Austrian economics. We got AAA there, don't we? Auburn, Alabama, Austrian.
That's right. You can't forget it. And anybody can visit us at www.mises.org. We have the largest and most trafficked economic web page in the entire world, and it's all available for free, downloading, printing, and viewing, and it just has a host of information on any topic, basically, that's even mildly related to economics.
Absolutely right. It's a great, it's a fantastic resource. And most free, most of it's free.
Yep.
Unless you order from the bookstore or similar.
And yeah, all you can download and read all the books online. It's really fabulous.
It is. And Lou Rockwell, he's your boss.
That's right.
There, had an article today about recession, and one of his main points was that this uptick that we just experienced in the reported unemployment rate, and 3/10 increase, by the way, is statistically significant. Something less than that is not. Of course, it comes from a household survey of some 60,000 households every month. So it is statistically significant, probably at the 5% level. And one of his main points was that the way I'd put it is that's a more of a concurrent, it's an effect. It's not a cause of recession to have a higher unemployment. In fact, it's a consequence or an effect. So, and I noticed one other news item here, Mark. Down in some DeKalb County in Georgia, we're opening a new Walmart where they're going to hire. They did minimal or no advertising. They have 300 to 400 slots to fill, and 7,500 people showed up.
Wow, that tells you a lot.
That tells me something. I wouldn't dismiss that as a random straw in the wind. So I gather you would agree with your boss on this labor market thing is more of an effect than a cause. So what's the cause of this this worsening in the labor market?
Yeah, you're absolutely on point here, Morgan. And if you've been reading Mises.org, for the last several years, you would have seen that the Austrian economists were anticipating this recession for a very long time, and we were chronicling the housing bubble and what the Fed was doing to cause this housing bubble as early as late 2002. So we know what the cause of the bubble is. We know it's going to end in a bust or a recession. So we've actually been anticipating and alerting our readers that this was going to happen on LouRockwell.com. I actually picked the top in the housing market within a week. And in terms of the housing
now, that's
top,
better than a dartboard usually does.
And that's in August of 2005, before anybody started even talking about a housing bubble. And so we've been anticipating this recession all along, and you would have seen references to the fact that the economy has been deteriorating and contracting, maybe not in recession, but contracting for quite some time. And so this is no big shock to us that the recession
now, if you had
has
to pick,
started.
Pick two letters, I've got my two letters in the United States economy. Who or what is the cause of the boom and therefore the inevitable, if always unique, bust?
Well, I mean, Alan Greenspan.
Oh, AG would be your initials.
Yes. Alan Greenspan, the chairman of the Fed, he brought interest rates down to 1% after 2001. And, you know, you saw the impact that had on the housing sector because people could borrow money essentially at a very low cost. And the banking system was so flooded with credit and reserves,
right,
they were pushing money into the market. And when that happens, when they push massive volumes of credit into the market, credit standards have to go down. Banks always go to their best worthy customers first, and then if they've got more money left over, they go to less credit worthy borrowers. And so you had people who weren't credit worthy getting tons of credit. And
standards somehow slipped, didn't they?
Yeah. I mean, it's a perfect illustration of the Austrian theory of the business cycle, how the Federal Reserve creates money out of thin air, gives it to the banks, who then makes lots of money making loans, but inevitably some of those borrowers are going to go bust, and that's what's been happening. Home builders are going under, construction firms are going under, banks are going under, mortgage originators, subprime originators are going under, they're contracting, and so then eventually, yes, it starts to show up in unemployment in the unemployment rate, and that's what we're seeing right now. While you have the mainstream economists, they're still wondering if we're going to go into recession. You know, they're just now starting that debate.
Oh, well, you know, it's amazing to me. Back in August, you could see that finally this is going to break. You know, the subprime belly up mortgages, and it's contained was the argument. And then for a couple months, people, you know, the market went back to its normal kind of mindless behavior. And now it's broken out a bit. In fact, I anticipated this part of it privately, where I said, well, that's fine. They can jolly this along with more liquidity injections, you know, new scraps of paper. But the market's going to sober up here. And that's happened. Somebody was claiming, for example, that probably the net worth, the present value, this was pre all these bangs on Merrill Lynch and Citi and Bear Stearns and all that. They only have kind of net value of maybe $200 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And a Goldman analyst is predicting that there will be a fourth quarter write-down of $19 billion, and kind of the median estimate is $11 billion. I mean, these are just huge, huge hits, and I wouldn't be surprised. Now they'll probably bail, but here listen to this. When Bernanke makes a statement like this, well, let me build this up, because at the University of Arkansas, the president who's going to resign or quit as of the June 30 said to the basketball coach a year ago, "We've got your back, Stan." He was out the door in 3 weeks. And that sets the stage for what Bernanke is telling the America and the banking system in the world. We'll be back after the break. This is your host, Morgan Reynolds, on the Dynamic Duo, where you can catch Jim Fetzer Tuesdays through Thursdays and Kevin Barrett on Mondays and Fridays. Today, my special guest is Mark Thornton from the Mises Institute. And having this conversation, I think, at the right time, where the economy is exciting as all get out. And when we left for the break, I was telling Mark about, and the listeners, about the University of Arkansas president some year and a half ago told the men's basketball coach Stan Heath that "We've got your back." Stan Heath was dismissed 3 weeks later. Well, this reminds me of the statement here that Bernanke, there's a similarity here, where once the central banker makes a statement like this, you got to wonder about the bank that you're banking at. He said, and I quote today, "Notwithstanding the effects of multi-billion dollar write-downs on the earnings and share prices of some large institutions, the banking system remains sound." Mark, we've reached the point now where the Federal Reserve chief says the banking system remains sound.
Yeah, Bernanke has learned green spam, where anything they say, you should just delete it from your mind, because they're basically misleading you with all their statements and pumping up the economy and telling you that all of the economic problems are caused by somebody other than the Federal Reserve. I quoted Bernanke from a 2005 talk that he gave, where he said that he had discussed with bank regulators and found that lending standards were now better than they had ever been in the past, and that he was completely satisfied with that analysis. And, of course, that was exactly when all of these banks and lending institutions were coming up with all these bizarre loans where people could borrow more than 100% of the value.
Yeah, more than 100% or interest only.
Yeah, interest only. Just some amazing crackpot financial deals that have gotten so many people in this country in trouble and have cost them, in many cases, their house. And this is going to continue on. This is not something that they've fixed. People are going to be losing their house as the subprime rates loans reset themselves from adjustable rates on up to the current rates, from teaser rates on up to the current rate. And this is spreading into not just subprime, but it's going to eventually spread into the prime rate loan market as well. So,
oh, yes, I'm sure it has. Hey, Mark, are you on a speakerphone now?
Yes, I am.
Go back to the handset because the quality deteriorated. And, you know, this business, there was a headline here on PrudentBear.com about the risk of arson with all these foreclosures. You still there, Mark? Oh. Okay, well, we're on the air, and I've got a lot more about Mr. Bernanke, the head of the Federal Reserve System. He said also today that inflation expectations were, quote, reasonably well anchored, unquote, and he pledged to monitor those expectations closely. So what is he saying? He's trying to massage and therefore deceive, trying to massage public confidence that they're, and just move on, there's nothing wrong here, there's no reason to panic or take your money out of the bank, right? There's confidence. He's trying to maintain confidence, and he's claiming that inflation expectations are reasonably well anchored. In other words, that people still have confidence in the paper money, the scraps of paper that they basically generate out of thin air. Maybe you need a printing press, but it's definitely linked to the debt system. I remember, and maybe Mark doesn't, although Mark's a scholar, so he's heard. We still have the expression "good as gold." Hello, Mark, are you there?
I am. Sorry for cutting myself off there.
Yeah, pushed the wrong button.
Pushed the wrong button.
Yeah,
I'm not a button pusher like they are at the Federal Reserve.
Right. Yeah, I was just saying we have the expression they produce these new scraps of paper that are so highly valued out of thin air. But even Bernanke, before he became head of the Fed, said, oh, yeah, we have this wonderful invention called the printing press. Well, one of the things that's wrong with this, let me get your response, is while you can definitely push on this rod, maybe it's not a string, and inject liquidity, new reserves into the system. The problem is it's not very target efficient if you're trying to sustain asset values, which are, hey, subject to change. So that, for example, the housing values or prices are not going to be especially helped by all this agitation and flooding the market with newly created money, is it?
No, I mean, it keeps the system inflated for a while, but ultimately all of that asset price changes in housing is going to have to occur. This is just giving cover for the financial firms to try to allow them to recover from this and to protect themselves while the average Joe on the street is being told that we have confidence in the system, so they're not adjusting quickly enough to these problems, and they're going to be hurt even worse. You know, Japan tried this flooding the economy with money and credit and bringing interest rates down to just above zero, and ultimately, you know, that kept the financial firms going, but the average Japanese in the economy was in recession for a very long period of time.
Oh, yes. Really stagnation for a decade and a half.
Yeah, real estate prices declined in Japan for 15 years
mm-hmm.
as a result of their bubble and subsequent bust and the effort on the part of the Bank of Japan to keep the whole thing going. It only keeps it going for the financial firms.
Yes, although it's done in the name of the public good.
Right. It's done in the name of homeowners keeping their homes.
Right.
But that's not the real motivation here. The real motivation is to protect the financial firms and to see if most of them can make it through without being hurt.
Yeah, an example from the early 90s was that they were bailing out Mexico. No, you're not. You know, you're bailing out Goldman and other investment bankers with their neck in the noose, right, with the Mexican government.
Yeah, and it's important to note, it's very rarely mentioned, but the Secretary of the Treasury is the CEO of Goldman Sachs.
Yes, the former.
The former, well,
yeah.
He's...
Isn't it interesting that Goldman was especially alert and had sold short on the subprime and CDO packages? But here's the thing I want to bring up to you. This is a good point to bring up this whole question when you're talking about the Feds bailing out the banks and the investment banks and the financial system and all those movers and shakers rather than the general public. Murray Rothbard, God bless his soul, I grow in admiration every day, it seems, about his body of work. But he says the Federal Reserve is a governmentally created and sanctioned cartel device to enable the nation's banks to inflate the money supply in a coordinated fashion. And on the other side of that break, we're going to pick up Mark Norton's analysis of that statement. This is your host, Morgan Reynolds, on the Dynamic Duo, where you can catch Jim Fetzer Tuesdays through Thursdays and Kevin Barrett, the Boy Wonder, on Mondays and Fridays. I'm filling in for Jim this week on Thursday, and we've got a marvelous guest here, Mark Thornton, who's a senior fellow at the Mises Institute down in Auburn, Alabama, and a PhD economist. And we couldn't be having this conversation perhaps at a better time because it seems we've got a turning point here. We're moving from boom to bust. And on the other side of the break, I was quoting one of the great economists of the 20th century, and historian and political analyst and activist, Murray Rothbard, who said in his book on the history of money and banking in the United States regarding why was the Fed created in 1913, he said, "The Federal Reserve is a governmentally created and sanctioned cartel device to enable the nation's banks to inflate the money supply in a coordinated fashion without suffering quick retribution from depositors or note holders demanding cash." So, Mark, is that really what the Fed is all about, is a coordinated inflation device?
Absolutely. Murray was right on the money as usual. The Federal Reserve was established by banking interests in 1913 after a two-decade lead-up of advocacy for a new central bank.
It was amazing, that propaganda run they had.
That's right. But banks, if they can make more loans, they can make more money. But if they make too many loans, and some of those loans turn out to be bad, then they lose money. So they needed a device that would permit them to make more and more loans, but then have something to as a cushion when things in the economy went bad. And so the idea of a central bank was promoted on the part of leading bankers in the United States surreptitiously in order to provide them with a cartel device which kept everybody, all of the major banks, from being hurt by when the inevitable bust came around. And that's exactly what we're seeing here today.
Yeah, back another item that is fascinating from Rothbard's history here is that the Brits, the financial elitists at the Treasury and the Bank of England, et cetera, referred to the irresponsible public or sound currency fanatics, as well as foreign speculators, who would show up and say, "Hey, I want my, I'm demanding my deposits in full in my demand deposit account or checking account." Well, wait a minute, we're going to have a bank holiday.
That's right. People left to their own devices, without any government intervention, would use gold and silver coins as money. And as stipulated in the U.S. Constitution, I might add. But banks don't like that process because it keeps a cap on their profitability. And so they want to have paper money, they want to be able to create money, and they want a central bank as a lender of last resort. And when they say lender of last resort, it's not loans to Morgan Reynolds or Mark Thornton that they're talking about. It's loans to J.P. Morgan and Wall Street that they're thinking about in terms of a lender of last resort.
Now, I think we have the first sign that I can really detect where the Financial Times, which is really the newspaper of, it's claimed, the international bankers, and it's certainly all establishment, City of London. There's a headline in their story of January 8th, gold is the new global currency. And this is quite a turnabout for this organization to recognize that gold, and it almost hints at gold, as you pointed out, gold coins, silver coins that used to circulate, and you'd have bullion for big payments. But the point is that the paper, these, well, they really should be warehouse certificates, but we know how that's been abused. But the point is that even when you have a gold base and circulating and in the hands of the public, that provides a very tight check on the banks and the government, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, when you have a system like that where banks, you know, have to redeem their deposits on demand in terms of gold and silver coins, that keeps the whole monetary system stable, not set in concrete, but very stable. And so you don't get price inflation in the economy. You don't get distortions in the economy. You don't get the business cycle in the economy.
And you don't need as much of an inflation premium. It's a low interest rate economy when you've got this kind of stability or security confidence.
Absolutely. The, you know, without any inflation premium, and actually possibly even a deflationary premium built into interest rates, savings can be turned into loans at relatively low interest rates. You know, the interest rates that we're experiencing now, which seem, you know, historically very, very low, are actually the norm under the gold standard. It's just after we went off the gold standard did interest rates go up to 20% and have gradually worked their way back down. But under a gold standard, interest rates tend to be very low. So it doesn't prevent banking. It doesn't prevent people from getting loans for homes and for business purposes. And it keeps everything very stable so that the average Joe does much better under a gold standard, and banks don't do as well as they do with a Federal Reserve central bank waiting to not only inject a lot of reserves into the system, but also to bail them out when the reckoning time comes.
Right, and the reckoning should come. It keeps the system, the financial sector, the banking system, and particularly on a short leash. And if so, you're not going to have the such severe business cycles, this boom bust, because the boom is essentially not synthetic or artificial, right? In other words, it's more stable growth without such erratic ups and downs via the boom-bust mechanism that's really traced to the banking system and the central bank.
Yes, the in the 19th century, you know, they didn't often refer to depressions or recessions. They had panics.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you think of panic as everybody panicking, but it was really a panic within the banking system brought about both because of government regulation and banks going too far, too fast, and then having to pay the consequences of that. And so it was those panics.
Yeah.
Banks did, you know, very poorly, and some of them went out of business. That's what they thought the government could provide them with the power that a central bank provides so as to keep their operations safe from the inevitable changes in the business cycle.
Well, this Financial Times headline I referred to, gold is the new global currency, that leads me to the idea of reform, and you're backing Ron Paul as a presidential candidate, right?
Absolutely. Personally, I'm a delegate. I'm a precinct captain. I've known Ron Paul for 23 years. He's a wonderful man. He knows economics backward and forward. He knows American history backward and forward. He knows foreign affairs because he's been on those committees backward and forward, and I believe that he has the right reforms that are necessary. All the other candidates are talking about change, and they don't represent any change at all. It's Ron Paul
who
represents the real change.
Mm-hmm.
And and he wants to bring us back to a gold standard. He wants to put the wraps on the Federal Reserve System as much as possible. And
he actually has in the past submitted bills to pull their charter and dissolve the Federal Reserve, hasn't he?
Absolutely. And he attacks Bernanke and Greenspan every chance he gets. He's because he's on the House Banking Committee.
More power to him on those issues, Ron.
There's some great YouTubes of him attacking Bernanke and Alan Greenspan. If your listeners want to go out there and see Ron Paul in action.
Very good. Here's the break, and we'll rejoin Mark Thornton on the other side. This is your host, Morgan Reynolds, on the Dynamic Duo, where you can catch Jim Fetzer Tuesdays through Thursdays and Kevin Barrett, the Boy Wonder, on Mondays and Fridays. I am substituting for Jim Fetzer this week, and my guest is Mark Thornton, an economist and a senior fellow at the Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama. And we're focusing on the current economic situation and words like gold and scraps of paper and manipulation and cartels and banks show up. Mark, this new device that the Fed is using with these monthly auctions of $30 billion, and what's going on there? I understand that, of course, in the Fed funds markets, these overnight loans between banks, and the Fed targets this Fed funds rate, which is now at 4.25%, and rumor has it, or markets are betting they'll cut it a half a point to 3.75%. But is it true that that we're in a bit of a credit crunch because one bank doesn't trust the other about whether it's sound? In other words, there's no transparency. Who's really holding a lot of bad debt? And you don't want to lend money to a bank that is unsound and looks like it might go under and therefore leave you with only cents on the dollar. Is that what's going on with this device?
That's the $64 billion question there, Morgan. But the Fed would traditionally handle this by injecting money into the federal funds market, which banks borrow from other banks.
Mm-hmm.
And they also have the discount rate window, where banks that are in trouble and can't get money from other banks go to the Fed directly for loans.
But that's why they don't want to use it, right?
That's right. They don't want to use that because that
they're
indicates...
They're admitting they're unsound.
That's right. They're admitting they're unsound. And so in order to get around that, instead of asking the banks to come to the Fed is going to the banks with these auctions and mandating that the banking system absorb $30 billion in new reserves. And banks are all encouraged to put in some kind of bid for those reserves. And, you know, the money goes around to the various winning bidders. But nobody.
But it's almost like forced feeding the horse at the water trough, huh?
Absolutely. A direct injection into the gut of the horse or the banks on Wall Street. It's really kind of an innovative idea, something you might not expect from a college professor, but that's what they came up with, and it helps to unwind some of this the credit problems. But the banking houses, they all have tens and tens and tens of billions of dollars of loans which are considered suspicious,
right?
And many of them are clearly bad. They can't write them down fast enough without acquiring new capital in order to meet the capital requirements of the regulators, and that's why they've been going overseas in order to get capital money, fresh cash, so that they can write down some of the bad loans so that they can show investors...
They can fluff up their balance sheet in order to write down.
Right, and they need to write this stuff down because it's non-performing. And that's the squeeze that they're all in simultaneously.
Well, did you gain some special insights when you were an assistant supervisor of the Alabama banking system and an aide to Fob James, the governor?
Not really. The state banking system, regulatory system, is different from the Federal Reserve system, obviously, and we didn't have the power, the legislative authority, to create new reserves or anything like that. We were, strictly speaking, a regulator of quality and the accounting aspects of state chartered banks. And most of my job was actually serving as an economic analyst for the governor's office and the banking department. And so I was working on everything from the, you know, state employee pensions, job training programs.
Oh, okay. Jack of all trades.
I was looking at the whole thing. And, you know, when I first was asked to do that job, I thought to myself, I wasn't really interested in state economic policy. But it turns out, of course, that the state governments are franchises for the federal government. It's like McDonald's or something,
right?
Where the states are really running all of these federal programs.
Right. It's the unitary state in all but name.
Right. And so
we have the form of a federal republic, but not the content.
Yeah, I was in on the ground floor in terms of analyzing, the welfare, health care. Everything that the federal government does, the state actually does for them. And so it was a tremendous experience, both in banking as well as all the federal programs that are out there, and analyzing them, how effective they were in terms of getting results. And very often I found that they were getting absolutely no positive results for a lot of these programs,
right.
Where,
yeah.
A job training programs, for example, would, spend millions of dollars. And yet, of all the people who were enrolled in those programs, not one of them, over a two-year period, had a job after 6 months.
Yeah. That's why some people claim, back where I came from, the University of Wisconsin, that, well, it's just unfortunate that the Great Society programs and New Frontier and all came about at the same time cost-benefit analysis did. where you track these graduates or dropouts of these training programs, for example, and find that their successes were modest to none.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to gold now. There's a couple of things here I don't quite understand. Where if I look at this Financial Times account that claims gold is the new global currency, they say that back in 1999, the UK, the Bank of England, decided to sell 60% of its official holdings, and gold then was about $250 US a troy ounce, 1999. And they remark, well, this looks like a particularly poor judgment. But they also claim, and I don't know that this is right, let's see if you know. They say that the Fed remains the world's biggest holder of gold. And I'm thinking, this Fort Knox. Now, the Fed may act as the agent, but I thought the Treasury owned all this gold, the United States government.
Both have gold holdings, all held at the Fed. And,
okay.
But the central banks around the world have had a relatively coordinated effort for many, many years to sell off their gold holdings into the marketplace, and of course this has kept the price of gold lower than it otherwise would have been. And so these gold sales, and I think the Swiss Central Bank announced that it was going to sell something like 250 million tons or million ounces over the next
ounces,
over the next several years. And and this is designed to get revenues for them, but also to...
But that's never worked. That's never worked. When they inject new supply, demand goes up because people say, uh-oh, they're going to debase the currency even faster.
Smart people.
There's a lot of smarties out there. So we'll be back with Mark Thornton after the break. This is your host, Morgan Reynolds, on the Dynamic Duo, where you can catch Jim Fetzer Tuesdays through Thursdays and Kevin Barrett, the Boy Wonder, on Mondays and Fridays. And hey, I got to love that Beatles song, The Tax Man. It reminds me, I think it was Serena Williams, the famous tennis player. One time she was, Bill Clinton came to the U.S. Open, and she was asking, why are taxes so high? You can imagine, she's making millions, what her tax bill with the federal income, personal income tax, and he laughed it off, ha, 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 ha. She was serious, and the Beatles are serious when they're talking about the tax man, one of the many undesirable interventions in our personal lives and the economy.
Morgan, yes. I've rewritten the tax man to turn that song from sort of an abusive tax collector into the voice of a radical tax opponent.
Mm-hmm.
You might have seen that on LouRockwell.com, and I also rewrote the songs, the words to the Beatles' Revolution song, so that it was now the Ron Paul Revolution song.
Oh, okay, I didn't know that. So you've got new lyrics to their music.
That's right.
Okay, we got to recruit a good vocalist for that.
I'll send you one of them.
Okay, very good. Mark, I wanted to turn to this issue that I don't think the public understands well, nor do mainstream economists, because you see all this printing and gyrations and anything to avoid a recession, and yet Austrian economists argue that the recession is actually the recovery of economic health, that the boom had overconsumption and malinvestment or bad investments that shouldn't be bailed out, because we want to get the production system through the market process aligned with consumer desires. And a recession needn't be long and deep. It can be short and cleansing. And what a lot of this modern policy has done is, it seems, if we listen to Roger Garrison, an economist, a great, I think, macroeconomist down there at Auburn, he argues that while depth of these recessions is kind of modest by keeping all these walking wounded bad investments going, the duration tends to be long. Maybe Japan's a really dramatic case. So is a recession, shouldn't we just let the recession run and maybe even pull back on some of these aggravating interventions?
Oh, absolutely. When you let the recession occur, it tends to be far better for the average guy in the economy. The recession tends to be swift. The owners of assets and the owners of company, they change hands as certain companies go bankrupt. But the whole thing is over with much quicker. If you try to intervene to keep your friends in banking propped up, the recession takes a very long time to get unwound. And government gets in there to try to intervene, like Roosevelt did with the New Deal, and you see these recessions dragging on for very long times. So it's a mistake.
Or Herbert Hoover did with the early New Deal.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Roosevelt was just following Hoover, what Hoover had already done. It wasn't working, but he still was following that because he was predisposed
for government intervention. Yeah, only bigger and worse. Yes.
And so, you know, we need to realize, as people did in the past, in the 19th century, people realized that the recession was the cleansing period where the economy returned back to normal and all of the bad assets were disposed of or changed hands. But, you know, for the most part, there wasn't high rates of unemployment. There wasn't a lot of dislocations for the average person. It was just the owners of corporations, the owners of banks that would have to change hands. And that's a much better way of dealing with the problem, is to allow the recession to take place, to allow markets to restore order and to ferret out some of these bad investments and get us back on the normal growth path in the economy.
Yeah, one of the things that's played into this, though, is I remember after the Great War, it was then known, or we know it as World War One. At the end of it, the general tenor of public commentary was everything is too high, and that was based on not just that episode, but historical experience that there was inflations during wars, and everything's too high, including wage rates. And the 1921 recession was about a 6 month or 8 month or 10 month deal, where unemployment went up and the usual, but the reallocations of assets into newer. This really bothers me is that entrepreneurs are such a vital role in the economy. They make things happen, and then consumer votes via dollars decide who's right and who's wrong about pleasing consumers in this long chain of production. And when you keep the walking wounded, you're keeping assets in the hands of failed investments, failed enterprises that consumers have voted out, but you're keeping them on life support, and that doesn't make any sense.
No, and it penalizes the people who are prudent, people who save, people who, you know, protect themselves, and it rewards people who have gone out on a limb, have taken unhealthy risks,
mm-hmm.
and so it really turns the incentives completely upside down, away from the natural economy to those of the interventionist government economy, where bad economic moves are rewarded and where good economic moves are stymied or actually hurt.
It's amazing how in public discussion valid economic analysis plays little or no role. And instead, for example, you hear, first of all, that consumer spending is the heart of the economy. Okay, well, it's true that the ultimate end of economic activity is consumption, but like spending is supposed to be the driving force. No, it's not. You know, it's Say's law, the production side is really important. And then the other thing that occurs to me here, Mark, is that the one reason back is that was the last so-called free market recession was 1921. Well, people didn't think that you could stop them. They were like power outages or a tornado. Whereas now we believe, and economists have risen to the role, that we're scientists of the economy, and this elite can avoid all pain of readjusting.
Morgan, as you know, almost all economists are paid by the government. They get their money from the government.
Right.
That's I think that their spin comes from.
Well, we'll have more of this anti-economist talk by economists when we return. This is your host, Morgan Reynolds, on the Dynamic Duo, where you can catch Jim Fetzer Tuesdays through Thursdays and Kevin Barrett, the Boy Wonder, on Mondays and Fridays. I am substituting for Jim this week, my last day, and it's been fun. And our guest today is Mark Thornton from the Mises Institute in Auburn, Alabama. Mark is a PhD economist and sound money man and backer, very active in the Ron Paul campaign. And before the break, we were talking about economists, and Mark pointed out that most economists are on the government payroll and have this tell us that they're scientists of the economy. And one of the interesting things is now Ben Bernanke, he's Mr. Big. Reporters are hanging on every word. Investors are listening to, you know, anticipate what they're going to do, figure out what they have done. And the whole thing is an amazing kind of fraud in that These are supposed to be wise central planners who can somehow figure out what are the right interest rates in a market economy, what the money supply should be, and a lot of other policies. Does that make any sense?
Well, you know, you saw the study by Larry White where he showed 85 to 90% of the leading monetary economists either work for or have worked for the Federal Reserve. and the editorial boards of the leading journals in money and banking, 85 to 90% of the editorial boards are people from the Federal Reserve. And they don't make any bones about it that they try to influence research. And, of course, it goes well beyond government economists. There's thousands of economists who work for the federal government and state governments, but also state universities. All the big money jobs and chairs out there are usually at big state universities or the private universities, which get a lot of grants.
Oh, yeah. And look at MIT. I mean, just their defense contracts, it's like $1 billion a year.
So if you want to know where to find Austrian economists, well, you'd go to a private, small liberal arts college, and the chances are much better of finding an Austrian economist there. But if you go to, you know, the big state universities or the big government-funded universities of the Ivy League, you're not going to find any Austrian economists there. Because
right.
The federal government is basically, over the last 100 years, has rigged the system so that they're paying the big bucks to economists to tell and to tout the Federal Reserve line and the government line on all these issues. So they've, for example, they've completely rewritten the definition of inflation. It used to be inflation was increasing the supply of money for political means, and that was in the dictionary. Now inflation is just an increase in overall consumer prices. It doesn't lay out the blame for inflation. The old definition blamed the government. The new definition blames business, blames the consumer for increasing prices too much. So the Federal Reserve in that way protects itself from blame and pushes it off onto people like the oil companies and the entrepreneurs and middlemen, all that kind of stuff.
We're looking at a major consequence of inflationary or cheap money policies when you talk about the configuration of prices, the retail prices. Here's another thought I want to get your reaction to, and that is the euro, which is another paper money. But there, the bank head said, okay, we're sticking with this 4% Fed funds equivalent interest rate, and this was considered to be pretty stout. You know, we're going to keep the euro valuable relative to the dollar and yen and other major currencies. And the thought occurs to me, Ben Bernanke doesn't have the prestige, unearned though it may have been, of Alan Greenspan. You know, I called him always Mr. Magoo there at the Department of Labor. But he had, you know, the maestro reputation and all that. Now, Bernanke, to me, looks like a lightweight. And the way he's talking, he's almost dangerous, even for the powers that be, because he looks so reckless. And a currency really isn't that far from a hyperinflation when people start to abandon it. You can really have, I recall Henry Hazlitt talking about when MacArthur was invading the Philippines, and quickly the Japanese currency became worthless, you know. So it can go. Then the banking system, of course, this would be catastrophic in that you would have a financial collapse. And I'm wondering, are we toying with this at all because Bernanke seems like such a lightweight?
Well, Bernanke has made two separate but contradictory claims. One is he follows a monetary rule which says the Fed targets inflation at 2%. The other is that he will not permit deflation. He will not permit the economy to go in any kind of major recession or depression. And so right now he's fighting the recessionary aspects in the banking system. But one of the things that's coming loose is, of course, the value of the dollar is falling. It's at an all-time low against other foreign currencies. So if he keeps on going down this rate cut, if he keeps on going down the route of increasing the money supply, he's going to completely undermine his reputation as an inflation fighter. And once that happens, I think, you know, people are going to lose respect. I think that they'll learn that the Federal Reserve is never going to stop increasing the money supply. And at that point, I think people do abandon the dollar. If central banks around the world...
That makes gold and silver look even better.
That's right. Well, that's what people, smart people, are looking at right now is, you know, the alternative here, if Bernanke is going to fight this with monetary injections and not worry about the value of the dollar and worry about price inflation and gasoline prices, then they're going to go to gold. They're going to go to gold mm-hmm. and silver as an inflation hedge.
Yeah, the store of value aspect of FRNs, the Federal Reserve notes we carry around in our pockets, would be severely harmed, wouldn't they?
And this time around, real estate is not going to be a viable inflation hedge because of the housing bubble.
That's on a two-year decline by most forecasts, housing prices.
And it's got a long ways to go, if my analysis is correct, which it has been all along for the last 4 years. As a matter of fact, John Desjard, the chief economics correspondent from the Financial Times that you mentioned a while back, was speaking at the National Real Estate Development Conference here in the United States, and he said the only good research on real estate is being done in Auburn, Alabama, at the Mises Institute. And we were kind of shocked to hear. But he must have found us on the internet, and you know, that's the big difference this time around. So gold and silver, there are fewer good inflation hedges out there.
So can we have, I think the citizen might ask you, can you have an inflationary recession?
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. In an age of paper money, inflationary recessions are really the norm rather than so back in on the gold standard, you couldn't get it, but today,
yeah,
it's likely.
The return of the distinctly unlovely stagflation. So here's our break, and we will return to the last segment with economist Mark Thornton. This is your host, Morgan Reynolds, on the Dynamic Duo, where you can catch Jim Fetzer Tuesdays through Thursdays and Kevin Barrett, the Boy Wonder, on Mondays and Fridays. Today, in this last segment, I continue the interview with Mark Thornton, an economist and senior fellow at the Mises Institute. And, Mark, I saw a number here that I haven't confirmed, but it seems like it's in the ballpark, that if you add up all the total debt of households, corporations in the U.S., and all levels of government, including their trust fund obligations, you come up with a number, $48 trillion in debt, and that amounts to $165,000 per man, woman, and child. So a family of four, you know, if you just spread this out, it's $654,000 in debt. I mean, this debt thing has grown so enormous. And to me, one of the issues, and Ludwig von Mises brings this up, so even if you have this cleansing and readjustment of the production structure to match more what consumers want to second or vote in as sound, it just starts all over again. Because most people think there's nothing wrong with the cheap money and boundless credit expansion, so off you go again. So how can we stop this cycle?
Well, the cycle, has gone on for a long time. We're not sure how long, much longer it can be sustained. Several people, not that many, but think that this could do in the U.S. dollar and the U.S. banking system this time around, but, you know, that's been said before, and they've retrenched, and they've gotten themselves back.
They always stop short of going over the cliff, don't they?
That's right, but eventually they will, and the key is when Americans realize that they're never actually going to stop this increasing the money supply, piling on the debt, and they stop trying to hold dollars, and they get themselves into gold, and they spend their cash, that's when the whole thing will come unwired. what we need ultimately is return to the Constitution, where gold and silver are the medium of exchange. They are our money. We get rid of the Federal Reserve. It's unnecessary. It's only harmful. And we get the banks back on a sound financial status, where all demand deposits in banks have to be there in the bank on reserve.
Yeah, 100%.
That's right. We're only the only money banks can lend out is either their own money, money they've gotten from bonds, or money they've brought in as deposit for long-term CDs. But all demand deposits.
Those would all be real savings to be loaned and invested.
Exactly. So that real savings lines up with real investment in the economy, and those two things don't come unglued. The current system allows savings and investment to come unglued. So while you say Americans have all this debt, we also know that the American savings rate is near zero right now. So we're going into all this debt, but we're not matching that with new savings. And that's a natural consequence of the Fed injecting itself between savers and borrowers and distorting the whole system in such a way that it eventually causes a bust and a collapse in the economy and in the financial sector.
Isn't it amazing where, you know, this goes back to my earlier remark about how most public discussion, especially Wall Street and Washington, D.C., discussion of the economy and the like emphasizes spending as almost as if it were the source of wealth and income. But yet the older wisdom had it that really saving is a source that allows more capital formation, more productivity per labor hour, and all the flow of benefits from that.
And true wealth. Individuals true. Become truly wealthy. And I encourage everybody as individuals to go on the gold standard themselves, where they put their cash reserves in terms of gold and silver coins, so they're not hurt by all this monetary inflation and price inflation. At least they're protected, and you can't use it in common transactions at Walmart, but it's fairly easy to convert back into cash. So, that's one way an individual can start protecting themselves now is to invest in gold and silver coins. You can invest in gold and silver on the stock market. There's lots of ways of doing that, but I encourage
ETFs, the electronic transfer funds.
They have ETFs, and so, you know, that's a solid backing for people. You know, if you lose your job, you lose your house in a severe downturn, you've always got that cachet of gold and silver coins that is going to respond beneficially to monetary inflation and Federal Reserve actions.
That's done. Very good advice, as opposed to what seems to be so many banks that are shaky and keeping all your reserves there with the shaky bank.
I've been advocating gold since 1999. I've been advocating people get out of the dollar since the year 2001. I continue to do so, even though gold is near $900 an ounce. You know, if the dollar collapses, that means gold goes to infinity relative to the dollar. So I think it has a lot more to go, and I wouldn't discourage people just because the price has risen so much. I think it has a long ways to go. It's going to be very volatile. But the Fed does not seem to be cutting back at all at this point in time.
Let me switch the topic a little bit here. Last night I made a presentation on objectivism, Ayn Rand's philosophy. And I went in there thinking, I'm going to get a lot of resistance on her metaphysics, epistemology, maybe some on ethics, and maybe not very much on capitalism. Guess what? All the talk was, it turned out here, I was talking to 20 bleeding hearts. Now, that's a little exaggerated, but all of a sudden, after I gave her basic ideas, It was all about unregulated capitalism and sweatshops, exploitation. We're running out of food. What about resources? We have no clean water. On and on. the one about the objection about we're running out of food, it was said, have you looked at Americans lately?
Yeah.
So, but what I was taken aback by was just the number one was the moral indignation. The certainty of their views, that there was no other view. They were laughing, for example, I see people shaking their head. Well, the Great Depression is blamed on capitalism, but don't you think in a mixed economy it could be government intervention? You know, at least think about it as a scientist, you know, that you can't reject this out of hand. So that was I was taken aback at this the depth of economic ignorance is just towering.
Well, Americans have been greatly miseducated, and the younger they are, the more they tend to be miseducated, where they know all about extinctions and environmentalism and politically correct, but they know nothing of science. They know nothing of philosophy or real history. You know,
mm-hmm.
Every high school student can tell you that Thomas Jefferson was a slave owner, but nobody can tell you that he was the author of the Declaration of Independence. But I will say, looking at the Ron Paul Revolution, that young Americans have realized that they've been fed a line of propaganda, and they're realizing that America was great because it had this Constitution, that we obeyed it, and it was limited government, and limited government can solve all of our problems.
Yeah, if it would retract from unlimited government, unlimited invention.
And government power.
Boy, you know, people don't realize that the government is nothing but organized force. It's somebody picking up guns to create a better society. Isn't that that they believe that picking up a gun will create a better society? Well, thank you, Mark Thornton. It was a pleasure discussing the economy and economics with you.
Always a pleasure, Morgan.
And that's it for the Dynamic Duo this afternoon.